And if you write mathematics, it's got to be in sentences. And the words around it that I might write in English, someone else might write in German or Russian or Chinese. And it might be phrased slightly differently in different languages. but the mathematics stays the same.
Welcome to Season 3 of Her Story. This series delves into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. I'm Beck Bowman, and I'll be with you each week as we get to know these remarkable women whose lives have had a profound impact on communities throughout this state they choose to call home. Together, we will meet women who are cultural and environmental custodians, women in STEM and in business, women who care for the health and well-being of those around them, women who are changing the world from right here in WA. This is Season 3, Episode 1 of Her Story with Cheryl Prager. This is Her Story.
I'm Cheryl Prager, Professor of Mathematics at the University of Western Australia. I was inducted into the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame in 2015.
So I find it really interesting that you, at a very young age, realised that maths was this language that you kind of instinctively knew how to speak.
I remember I was 6 or 7. I was going into year 2 at school, second year, primary school, and I was so relieved that I found that negative numbers were legal. It hadn't actually made any sense that you couldn't take 5 from 3. -2, I didn't know what it was called, but that just seemed as valid as taking 3 from 5 and getting 2. And
yeah, and you could conceptualise all this at that age.
I don't know what I was conceptualising, but something made sense in year 2 that didn't in year 1.
I feel like that's such a gift, not just the ability to grasp that, but also to know at that young age, oh, I'm good at this.
Well, I don't know if that was what I heard, but I was, and perhaps it was a woman, I felt I needed permission to deal with negative numbers. Like I couldn't just do it. I needed the permission that they were okay, that you could, that they existed, that you could work with them.
Did you find that again elsewhere?
Well, I remember feeling very scared in a physics class in high school when the teacher was trying to find a solution of some process that, you know, would turn up into some graph that you would draw on the board. And someone else had given a solution that the teacher agreed with and everyone in the class agreed with and I disagreed with because it was describing a wave and maybe the wave was going from left to right and it should have been going the opposite direction. And so I said, well, I don't know, but I have a different answer and this is what I have. Seemed to me it took a lot of courage to even admit that I had something different. There seemed to be a vote, vote on which one was right. I mean, it was a very strange situation.
And which one was right?
Mine was.
And everyone voted for you as well?
Well, I don't know. I think the teacher then realised that there was a little twist in the logic and that had been overlooked before.
When we talk about your education, we're talking about primary school in Toowoomba.
Birth in Toowoomba. 2 moves later, I started primary school on Moreton Bay at Humpybong State School.
I feel like you must enjoy just like sliding that piece of information.
Yeah. My kids didn't actually believe it. So after my dad died, I remember my younger son was over there with my mum and we went for a drive and we visited this place and he said, oh, it really exists. It's a real place.
I've seen the sign. I've got a photo in front of it. But you ended up eventually studying in the big city.
Yeah, after yet another move up the coast, I was in year 9 when the family moved to Brisbane.
All this early mathematic willingness or like ease of grasping the numbers in front of you, was that recognised and nurtured by your family? Did your parents go, oh, hello,
Well, no. My dad obviously was very good with figures because he was an accountant in the Commercial Bank of Australia, and that's why we kept moving. We were moved every few years. But in the country at Nambour State High School, where I started high school, one of my maths teachers turned out had been someone that Dad had known in the army during the war. And Mr. James had said to my dad that I was very good at maths. I didn't know this, but I think that probably gave Dad enough confidence to allow me to finish school. He had been keen that I should learn commercial skills, which I was quite willing to do, as long as I could learn science as well, which I was much more keen on. So I was eventually allowed to complete school and do maths and science. It was not straightforward that that was going to happen.
Yeah, it's interesting that you, like, he didn't say that to you. He said it to your dad. This idea that maybe...
Yeah, I didn't know he said it.
You weren't to compliment kids too much in case they got a bit too big for their boots, you know? The compliment had to come in sideways.
Yes, that is interesting, isn't it? But yeah. I don't remember teachers in the country saying something like that to me. In the city, the school that I went to was a girls' school, and the teachers were more likely to have expectations that the girls would do as well as they could and would encourage them. But even there, I didn't know how good I was.
So how old would you have been? Say this was like sliding doors moment and your dad never had that talk with that teacher. How old would you have been when you had to leave school?
Oh, that would have been at the end of year 10. I would have left school. Dad had allowed me to do science in years 8 and 9. And if I was not going to go on, I would have gone to a business college and learnt commercial skills and then got a job in commerce somewhere.
Okay, we're going to have to go back because what does commercial skills mean?
Shorthand and typing.
Right.
And bookkeeping.
But only the bookkeeping has to do with maths.
I know, I know. I think I would have found it stifling.
Yeah.
But I was quite willing to do it if that's what I had to do in order to learn chemistry and physics.
Chemistry and physics is not where you ended up though, right? Like you ended up in the field of
pure mathematics. Yeah. It's kind of fundamental maths that is looking at forging new areas and understanding problems that may be applied in the future or may be applied mathematically. For example, working out the sorts of networks that you would need to store information on the World Wide Web, or working out the codes that you would use to send information electronically through the stratosphere. The sort of information that you might want to send back from Mars from a space mission would have to have a certain amount of redundancy, so that if some errors occurred, then when on receipt back on Earth, the actual message could be retrieved, because the message that had been sent had so much redundancy you could work out what the real message was if you made a mistake. And so these sorts of codes have a lot of symmetry, and they're the kinds of things that part of my work addresses. And yet I would call it pure mathematics because we're trying to work out all the different possible codes that you might use, and then in an application you might choose a particular one of them out of all the others that we'd invented.
What's so exciting about this for you? Because I can see your face is just like, oh my God, I want to talk about this more. But what is it about this that really kind of gets you so excited to think about the numbers.
Being able to use a lot of really powerful mathematics, the tools in jargon I would call finite simple group classification or something, to use really powerful tools to solve problems, to get a full view of the totality of all possibilities in some area. I mean, just nailing it, really understanding it is a great adrenaline rush.
It kind of sounds like to me that you are in the practice of developing solutions to problems that we haven't even thought of yet.
Yeah, except mathematicians are thinking of them, but the use of them perhaps we haven't discovered yet. All the uses.
Is mathematics the base language of the universe?
I would say yes. Galileo would say yes. It's the language that has been developed over centuries to help describe the world around us. And as we need to know more, then the language gets developed more and the maths becomes stronger and is used by scientists, by financiers, by farmers, by everyone in the community.
It really is the way that we operate now, that you wouldn't be able to turn on a computer or open an app on your phone without a mathematician who was there developing that algorithm.
That's right. And you wouldn't be able to send messages securely to your bank without fear of them being intercepted by an intruder.
Yeah. And it sounds maths. Like that was a mathematician 20 years ago thinking about that.
Or 50 years ago. Or, yes. Carol, before there were computers of that sort.
So does this mean that the work that you're doing now could find its application in another 50 years?
Yeah, something like that, yes. When computers get so strong that they want something better than they can use at the moment, then they will look forward to the next generation. So we're inventing the next generation of algorithms for computing with the maths of symmetry. That's part of what I'm doing at the moment. And it's so exciting to me. It's going to run so much faster than the ones we've got at the moment.
But is that also what gives you that passion or lights you up? Is this knowledge that you will live on through the mathematics that you are working on today?
I would like to hope that that will be the case, but I don't know whether that's what gives me the passion. I just love doing it, and I love working with students and colleagues, and I love seeing my students succeed. there's all sorts of reasons that we're happy.
I did download an app to get ready to talk to you because I was like, not great at numbers. So I downloaded this app that like promised to give me some mathematical ability. And it started right back at the fractions level.
Uh-huh.
If you were to start teaching someone mathematics today, if you were to rejig the whole like education system when it comes to teaching mathematics, where would you start? How would you do that?
Oh, gosh. When you started talking there, I was thinking, oh, yes, I remember bathing my two boys and they said to me, can you divide 2 by 4, as you're talking about fractions? And I thought, ooh, I don't know what their teachers would be teaching them about whether the answer is yes or no. And I said, well, it depends. If you had 2 apples, could you divide them into 4? And they thought, yeah, we could cut each one in half. Yep, we can do that. And then I said, and what if I gave you 2 towels? Could you divide them into 4? And then they realised that maybe it would depend on the what they're allowed to do. It's a matter of working out what are the rules that are going to be useful to help you to understand what's going on around us.
And so maybe that's the answer to your question, or to my question, is if we're going to be looking at how we're teaching mathematics, maybe that applied knowledge is going to light people up.
Yeah, it should make the world more understandable. And it should make the kids feel that they have the power to solve these problems.
When you think about the way that maths has infiltrated your life, how has it made your own life better? How have you been able to use the skills that you have developed through the years of study and work and apply them in different aspects of your own life?
Well, I remember visiting a university in southern Thailand and being asked by one of the mathematicians there about how to understand something in a book that he was reading. And it was a book about number theory and algebra. And I realised that when I'd been taught this, my lecturer had sort of drawn a picture on the board and just showed that what was being asserted was kind of obvious and believable, and that this picture had not been in the book and it hadn't been taught to these very talented mathematicians in Thailand. And so I gave them the picture and then they could see it as well. And so I realised that I'd been very fortunate in my education in being given the, you know, the results of a long history of development, of understanding. I mean, the actual question was, why are there as many grid points in the plane as there are number points on the line?
Mm.
You know, why aren't there more in the plane than there are on the one-dimensional line? And so there was this sort of zigzaggy argument about it that convinced students, if they thought about it long enough, that it wasn't at all clear. So I think that I've been very, very fortunate in the education I've had and in the development of through my research with students. But it's also led me to work with a lot of mathematicians in other countries, in developing countries in particular, and realising that the culture in those countries is different and what they are needing to do in their society is different from what I need to do in my society. For example, say in Thailand, they needed to translate English-speaking textbooks into Thai because that was going to be the most important thing for them in their society. And that was more important than getting a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And in China, when my students would come and see me, I could see that they had just about translated chapters of a book of mine into Chinese. And because the language issue was difficult in those days. So I also realise how fortunate I am to have had an education in English because that happens to be the dominant language of science at the moment.
We kind of think of language and numbers as two entirely separate things. But they influence each other in ways that aren't immediately obvious.
Yeah, well, numbers or writing equations is just a shorthand for a sentence. And if you write mathematics, it's got to be in sentences. And the words around it that I might write in English, someone else might write in German or Russian or Chinese. And it might be phrased slightly differently in different languages, but the mathematics stays the same.
You were the Foreign Secretary of the Australian Academy of Science for 4 years, and you've taught all around the world. So you've taught in Asia, Europe, the Americas. In terms of the history of the field of mathematics, what are some of the interesting things that you've learned about the ways that knowledge has crossed boundaries and crossed geographical boundaries and language barriers and ended up being something more, something that has lived on?
That's a fantastic question. Yeah. Because of the time that I've been living and working, I've experienced quite a few of these incidents. One time was in around about 1990, my first visit to the USSR. I went to Moscow to give some lectures and meet Russian mathematicians. And the person that picked me up said, I read a letter that you wrote to my professor in 1974. So that was 16 years earlier. And he wasn't allowed to reply to me, but his professor had written to my professor, said he'd like to hear about what was happening in mathematics in Australia by young mathematicians. And I'd written a very detailed letter saying what me and my colleagues had been working on in group theory and saying that I would love to hear back from them. And of course, I didn't hear back.
Yeah.
These 16 years, they weren't allowed to write to me. So I was given, in that two-week visit, a tutorial that lasted for 7 hours and started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon of all the different ways in which the mathematics had developed in Russia in sort of parallel with developments in the West. There was an excellent mathematician who knew all of these things, who was telling me. And some of the developments had been similar. They'd been given different words. Sometimes they'd gone in a different direction. But it was really fascinating to learn of this parallel development in the same kind of mathematics. And we were just on the point, just pivoted to start communicating again more readily. So that was one interesting experiment and incident.
So that was when you were studying group theory?
Yeah, I've been studying group theory all of my professional life. Yeah.
Can I just see if group theory is what I think it is?
I really study symmetry.
Right.
Symmetry. Like there's symmetry and everything. Symmetry in this microphone, which could turn around. And
do you know, I knew that that's what you were thinking when you sat down in front of that microphone and asked me where it should be. I was like, she's thinking about like the oh, where it's picking up the sound. I know yes. she is. Yeah.
So we measure symmetry via the operations that you can do to an object to sort of twist and turn it around and leave it essentially where it stays. So what has got symmetry around here? My glass of water, I could twist it around. I probably shouldn't upend it because that would
Please
be
don't.
Unfortunate. So the symmetries we're interested in would just be the rotations, and that would form a group of rotations. And there are symmetries of all kinds of objects in the world.
Your work developed alongside the Russian work.
Exactly. That was an interesting symmetry.
Yes. I love it. That it all kind of like melded together.
Yes.
That's beautiful. That is the universe.
The other instance I had been going to tell you about was with China, where their mathematics had got sort of stopped during the Cultural Revolution. That it was not possible for universities to function. And after the 17 years when they were just coming out of that, various Chinese mathematicians were sent around the world to learn about what had happened outside. And I was sent one of the professors from Peking University. And he had a particular task that he told me about eventually. That was to learn about a new area of mathematics where I was applying symmetry. It was called algebraic combinatorics. And he had to go back to China and start off a research area, a research group in algebraic combinatorics. How do I explain that one? That is like looking at structures like networks or like finite structures, like this glass of water has a certain number of beautiful little things in the side of it, so that if I turned it around, I'd like to match them up. And so I would only have a certain number, like 12 different twists I would be allowed to do with it. So it would be a finite number. And there are structures which have a lot of constraints like this. And we study them because they're useful to make beautiful pictures for graphs or to design experiments to test various products like drugs or farming crops against one another. So we need to understand the design of these sort of experiments we're going to have. So there's a lot of different applications. That was the start of my enduring links with Chinese mathematics. My colleague, Mingyao Xu, would choose various colleagues who would be sent out, spend a year with me, or sometimes they'd do their PhDs with me, and then I would see their students, and I have many, many students and grand students, great grand students with the group of algebraists and combinatorial people in China, and they are immensely strong now. It is just wonderful to see how much progress is being made around the world and what linkages, what networks there are.
When we talk about the work that you've been doing with people working in STEM in other countries and teaching people in Australia at UWA, have you seen a change in the number of women who are going through the course?
Definitely. I remember when I was myself a student, after my first year, I was the only woman in any of my mathematics courses, one out of 20 and then one out of 10 and one out of 8. These days we would see roughly between 40 and 60% of a first year class being women. Maybe they would choose slightly different majors than mathematics because you might use mathematics to pair with other scientific disciplines or computer science or business courses. But we still see quite a number of women taking their honours and their postgraduate courses in mathematics. I have several colleagues who are women, which is wonderful because when I was appointed professor way, way back, I was the only woman professor of mathematics at any Australian university. And now we've been counting up and there's 50 or 60 women, top, you know, level E professors in the mathematical sciences around the country, which is fantastic. But it's still only 10%.
It sounds amazing, like, to be the first woman in Australia. It also sounds really lonely. How did you sustain that dedication to the job, not just mathematics, but to the job that you were doing, when you were the only woman in your faculty?
In my school, yes. Mm. I was, in fact, the second woman in Australia to be appointed professor. And I had met the first one when I was a student, Hannah Neumann, but she had died in 1971, and it was 12 years later that I was appointed professor. So I had an idea of a role model. Everyone so respected and loved her, and she was known as a great teacher, a great researcher, and her staff just really, really thought she was a wonderful colleague. And so I wanted to be a mathematician like that. So I had a role model. It was not too much longer after my appointment that one of my teachers at the University of Queensland was appointed to a personal chair professorship as well. So it wasn't too much longer before there were a couple more around the country. But in my university, I was the only woman maths professor for a long time. And it was okay in my teaching and okay in my research. When I became head of department, I think that my colleagues felt uncertain. They didn't quite trust that I would make safe decisions for the university, for mathematics in the university. And I had a really interesting learning experience training myself and training them, so that if they asked me to go and ask a lot of questions of the faculty to see whether it would be safe for mathematics to move into the engineering faculty. That was a big question. Mm-hmm. They wanted to know how much money we would lose or gain by moving faculties. So I would go and I would talk to the dean and I would ask those questions, but also, how do the engineers feel about mathematics moving into the faculty? Engineering is a rather different discipline than mathematics. We teach differently. We don't have labs. We have a different culture. How would you feel? What would it be like? And so when I came back to my next meeting of my department, I could convey all sorts of information that I had learned. And then I was given the task of leading the maths department through a process of applying and then ultimately succeeding to change their faculties from science to engineering and computing and mathematics. So there was a big learning experience for me. I wasn't used to having that sort of responsibility. But also I think it was a learning of the whole department and university to understand and appreciate a different form of leadership. Mm. Very different having women around. Like when I was appointed professor, I wasn't just the only woman professor of mathematics in the country. I was one of two women professors in any discipline at all in the whole university. So it was not a normalised culture. Things are so much different now.
And now is 40 years later. You're coming up to your 40th year at UWA.
Yes, probably. Yes, exactly this year.
What has sustained you over that time? What is it about UWA that keeps you there?
I have really appreciated the leadership in the university over the years. I had a family who grew up here and didn't want to move. And that's really, really important to me. I did think about leaving. I applied for jobs in other places. I was offered a job. But I was very much appreciative of the support given to me and my research team in applying for a research fellowship later on in my life. I was the first pure mathematician to win a Federation Fellowship of the Australian Research Council, and that allowed my team to grow, to have more postgraduate students and postdoc fellows, and to, you know, do more exciting research projects and for the teaching to develop. I think having great colleagues to work with is the best thing for a worker, for an academic, for me, but in any area of life.
100%. Like, it's never the job, it's always the people.
Yeah.
Have your kids gone into this area?
Ooh, they would say no. There's no way they're going to be mathematicians. But they are mathematicians in their own right, I think. Both of them did university courses. One did a joint honours in pure mathematics and information technology, and he now works in software development in a sort of research role, but in an international company. And the other one did mechatronics engineering, and now he's working again in software engineering mm-hmm. development. They both have super strong math skills, and I'm enormously proud of them. As is my husband.
Oh, is your husband a mathematician?
He's a mathematical statistician. And he runs a statistical consulting company because his passion was to see that mathematical ideas or statistical ideas could really help the economy, could help solve problems in real life. And that's what he does all the time.
Are you the safest family in Perth? Like, if your husband's a statistician, do you run the numbers before you leave the house?
He's very much interested in what's going on, say, with the pandemic. Every day he would check.
Yeah.
Check numbers. Yeah.
I can imagine. We should have been calling him for information.
Yeah.
RTR is a radio station, right? So we are a little bit obsessed with music. I've always been told that music is a mathematical language. Do you have any experience with understanding of how that would work?
I love music. My mum tells me that when I was 2 years old, I would play the piano on the kitchen table because I had seen my uncle play the organ in the big church when we would visit the city from Toowoomba or Warwick. And I've learnt to play the piano. I have my A must A, my letters. And the first thing I ever wanted to do as a job was to be a concert pianist. I think that must have been after being taken for a birthday treat to hear a concert by Winifred Attwell in this country town where we were living. But then various things happened. It wasn't going to be possible. I broke my finger. I just love music. I sang in choirs. When I was a student in Oxford, I sang in the Hertford College Chapel Choir for 3 years and other colleges. I sang in an a cappella choir through the music department with David Tunley as a conductor for quite a number of years until I was professor and had to travel so much I couldn't make enough of the practices to sing in the choirs. But, I just love music.
So can you explain to me how it's a mathematical?
Well, certain parts of music are much easier to explain, like Bach's preludes and fugues have a really strong rules in which, there's a certain melody that's repeated, 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 and the structure of, say, some sonatas have got certain rules about them, part A, part B, plus A, part, just repeated again. Other people would look at the science of it and look at the notes themselves and the frequencies and think about what sequence of frequencies are pleasant to our ear to get the major and the minor tones, and then look at what happens in other cultures and what kinds of music are pleasant there. So that's like the tones, but then there's also the tempo, the rhythm. There's lots of mathematics.
I was just at the whole, whole note, quarter note, fractions level, but now I feel like I need to go and do some more reading about this. Last question. Where do you think that the field of pure mathematics is headed in Australia at the moment?
I think there are so many amazing new problems that we're facing because of the new technology that we've got. There's so much more capability of computers that just suggests ways in which you could use computers. You can't use them now until you get the right algorithms to underpin them. There's quantum computers on the horizon. We don't know how that's going to work, and there are huge mathematical questions which will need to be solved to underpin where that computation is going. And it will be enormously important for our security, for our coping with climate change, with our ability to understand the weather and what's happening around the whole world. And the pure maths is going to be done extracting the basic mathematical questions underpinning all of these real life problems that we're trying to solve.
I lied because I've got one more question that I've just thought of then. If you could upload your brain so that you could continue to work on your mathematical problems once your body had decided that it had enough, would you do it?
Heavens, would I do it? When you talked about uploading my brain, I'm thinking, well, I still do maths in my sleep.
Stop.
Which is terrible. I mean, it's absolutely awful if you can't sleep because you're trying to solve a problem.
I count backwards from 100 if I can't sleep. It works so quickly.
I don't know what the answer is to your question, Beck.
Yes or no, 50-50.
Okay, yes, why not? Someone else might get some information from it.
Cheryl, it has been so lovely talking to you. I feel like if I had you as a teacher, had you as someone in my life when I was in grade one or grade two, my relationship with numbers would be very different to what it is now.
That's sweet.
Thanks to Cheryl Prager and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women who make Her Story happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Rachel Ang and Madeline Mitchell are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Her Story is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was produced on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respects to the Aboriginal elders of the land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name is Beck Bowman. Join us next week when we meet a trailblazing CEO of sport.